697, relating to Alaska Renewable Resources Corporation, Senator Sertoluski. I believe this is...
Mr. Chairman, just so that you'll take a quick look at what you should have in your file, there'll be the original bill. The committee substitute for Senate Bill 697, Finance, a fiscal note, and you'll note that of $1,154,000 shows program receipts. We can talk about that later, but it's not general fund dollars. Legislative summary and a memorandum from Wayne Littleton, President Chief Executive Officer for the corporation, that tells how this revised program would be funded. We can, Mr. Littleton can explain that. But just very briefly, in terms of background, this is the sunset year for the Alaska Renewable Resources Corporation in...
'82?
Yes, and then it goes into its wind-down year. I think everybody's aware of the dissatisfaction, some based on fact and perhaps some misunderstanding on the corporation. And last year, the funding was really held down, and it was more of an on-hold basis. The issues, I think, were mainly in the area that came up, management structure, goals, purpose, and funding, all of those things that were talked about. There's been a lot of cooperation in working on this bill, both over the interim. A number of different legislators have been interested in it, and there's been a lot of good input, as well as we've had good help from Budget and Management has also looked at it. What you see in this bill will be a far more traditional management structure. It expands the allowable investments to a broader definition of resources, but it does focus on smaller businesses. In other words, it's not, you'll see that the renewable portion has been removed, so it allows for all the kinds of resources. I could go through in some detail on the legislative summary, perhaps to point out a few of the things, and then Dean Olson, Chairman of the Board, is here. Just a few things I'd like to point out, and you might want to follow along in your legislative summary. Section 1, it does delete the word renewable. It moves the corporation from revenue to the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. It still establishes a capital fund, and that's referred to in the memorandum from Mr. Littleton that shows the cash flow that would be generated. It changes the Board of Trustees to a far more conventional Board of Directors approach. It changes the board to four members along with the Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development. It calls for, does away with rather a substantial area of some concern, and that had been the ability to make grants. In this revised form before you, the board shall invest in economically viable projects by equity or debt investment at market rates, but it does allow for some change in financing. So perhaps at the earlier stages, of course, lowered interest, but overall, it needs to be a market rate approach. It limits that the board may not invest in one project more than 5% of the corporation's assets or $500,000, whichever is less. Again, this gets down into the small business approach. No grants can be made, no loans can be made for short-term working capital. It's subject to the Executive Budget Act. It does allow in Section 38, and I think this is important, the corporation currently has a number of outstanding investments, and it does allow for assistance to those continuing firms. In other words, they don't have to come under the quite the same conditions as new loans would be. And I think that's an important point we should explore a bit with Dean Olson. With those brief things, if we could ask Mr. Olson to come up and give a view of how they perceive this legislation, I think that would be helpful. Is that appropriate, Mr. Chairman?
Right, Senator Ford.
Mr. Olson, is there anyone you'd like to bring up with you, Mr. Littleton?
I
Chairman, my name is Dean Olson. I'm Chairman of the Board of Trustees of Renewable Resources Corporation. And with me are Bill Spear, Trustee of the Corporation, and Wayne Littleton, President of the Company. And we're at your pleasure, if you wish it that way, to respond to questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator?
I think it would be two areas, because questions have been raised. Number one, your understanding of the legislation and your current portfolio. Do you see that you're going to be able to, under this legislation, continue to serve those particular investments that the corporation now has? And then secondly, I think we need to go over your memorandum just a little bit to talk about this capital fund and how it would work and, say, your ability to make loans. I think those are the two. And then if you have comments, criticism, support for, or whatever, I'd appreciate hearing that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sackett.
Before we get started, do you have a passed-out portfolio list of all of your investments?
Mr. Chairman, no, we didn't bring an itemized list of the various investments. I can cite them. It would be helpful.
Probably the most recent statement of that, which the committee members have received in recent weeks, is provided in the annual report, which all members have received for the period ending June 30, 1981.
No, I don't have one in my file. I can get it. We'll get one for you. We'll have one here. With that, then, would you like to...
I'd like to ask Wayne if you wouldn't mind to respond to your questions.
Fine.
Sharon, the first portion of the question was, would we be able to continue to operate and monitor and maintain our existing projects under the new legislation? Yes, I think we would, reasonably effectively, because there is provision that we aren't limited the restrictions on the new legislative amount, et cetera. So we can operate effectively and continue to take care of the existing projects. With respect to our projection as what would happen this next fiscal year, be on a self-sustaining basis, we went through each of our investments on an individual case-by-case basis, reviewed the original terms of repayment, our expectation of the company's ability to meet the terms, and came up with a summary, which is represented in the memorandum all we have. Our program receipts are anticipated, and this is somewhat conservative, to be just a little under $4 million. Our operating expenses projected for fiscal year 83 are projected to be $1,154,000. Now, that projection assumes the corporation is going to be restructured from a trustee standpoint. We would not have three full-time trustees, but instead we'd have a five-man board that would meet monthly for a certain stipend and per diem. In addition to covering that expense, we feel that at a minimum, income generation, as well as principal repayments this next fiscal year, would generate about $3 million more for investment. We currently have a cash fund, which are prior principal repayments, as well as conditional commitments that have expired, that would increase this amount available for investment this next fiscal year to close to $11 million. I anticipate subsequent years, as existing investments go on stream on a principal repayment basis, this would increase to where a minimum we'd have about $3 million a year.
Mr. Chairman. The $3 million a year, you're talking about as funds that could be available then for venture capital investments. Thank
you. Senator Eliza?
Are there going to be any, are we looking towards further appropriations to the corporation?
Mr. Chairman, on the basis and the way the legislation is set up, it would be like a revolving loan fund. And unless the legislature at some point wished to expand the capital, it would work within the dollars that have already gone to ARC.
So we're looking at approximately $3 million a year for reinvestment?
Mr. Littleton, can you make that with some assured feeling that that would be an ongoing ability to provide approximately $3 million?
Yes, I can at a minimum. And I'm basing the $3 million this next year on what the program or projects we have now and the known repayments. Some of those programs or projects have deferred principal repayments for a period of time, deferred interest payments. They aren't accrued, they are still accrued. So at the minimum, I anticipate $2 million a year in regenerated capital for investment.
We're looking at as low as 6 loans a year? Very big operation.
Turn second.
What's the purpose of the artist of your work draft? What's the purpose of this new corporation?
Well, it allows for an area that we don't cover in the various other programs, really in the area of development of finance, and it allows for debt equity investment in resource type of investments. That's basically the purpose of it. Not limited to the renewable resource, as was the earlier bill. I don't know if you have any comment you'd like to make on the part of the board on that.
Is the work draft copy that before us something that's proposed by ARC, or is it your?
There's been a lot of, very frankly, a lot of work on this. There's been work by the Senate Banking Committee, Senator Kelly's staff, Bell and Daniels did work on it, my staff, and I have done work on it. So it's been Senator Dankworth had some concerns over the management structure. We worked with his staff on it. So there's been a lot of effort in developing this. So I don't think any, and certainly with the board of ARC had done a management study, and so there's been some participation. I don't know that any one group is leading the charge on this. I think there's been input from a good number of sources.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dankworth.
Senator Sackett, also, I think you have to, the need, I think your question is, why do we need this? You know, what are we doing in the purpose part? We couldn't hardly allow to leave ARC the way it was. Something needed to be done, or at least as I viewed it. It just couldn't hang out there. So this is probably, even in my judgment, as limited as it is on banking, I would say that probably this is even a stopgap measure in the sense that it would be my prediction that the new governor and the new legislature will eventually look at all these loan programs. I don't see that happening this year, and something had to be brought together to correct some of it. Even the ARC itself, I believe, agrees that it needed some changes and that the management structure needed some reevaluating and they needed some new direction. My main complaint against ARC all along was not in the kind of people that were running it. It wasn't in all that type of thing, but I always thought that they didn't have enough direction and that the legislation was vague and wasn't set up right. But at any rate, to answer your question, I think we have to do something, and this, I think, would best satisfy those needs. I did want to, while I've got the floor, though, in dealing with Section 27, Wayne, or any of the Board of Trustees might answer this, and we've changed the word resource to taken out the word renewable. If I understand now, the new definition of resource is included but not limited to fisheries, agriculture, forest products, renewable energy. I don't know if that means dams, whether that means windmills, or just what that means. I'd like to see if somebody can. I don't have any problem with it. I just don't understand it. Tourism and mining. I think that's a great improvement that we include tourism in there because that is a resource and it's a renewable one. But excluding real estate. Now, does that include excluding boats? Are we going to continue to buy fishing boats, or what about the Snobble Lumber Mill? Do we own a piece of that now, and our equity investments into those type of things? Would you address that a little bit as how you see this new section working and what we can and can't do?
Well, with respect to, Mr. Chairman, with respect to boats, the position has been taken that boat financing is adequately covered in other programs, not only state but also federal programs. So we haven't really been involved in financing boats.
Well, canneries. I should say canneries and what else you call
processing.
Processing plants and stuff. You're into those pretty deeply, and that's real estate.
That's right. In those,
We haven't necessarily provided funds to acquire a facility. We've been more involved in a restructuring type of mode. Now, my feeling as far as excluding real estate development is that we don't want to offer ourselves another secondary market, develop subdivisions and this type of thing. The intent is, when we get involved with an investment that falls within this category, that we still have the ability to take real estate as collateral to support the loan position and perhaps participate in acquiring a manufacturing facility, but not be a substitute real estate loan agency.
Okay. I'm not sure that I'm completely satisfied with what you can do there, but I know that you still are capable. Are you still able under this bill? Arliss, you may want to answer, but are you still able to make equity investments, or will you be able to get involved in an equity situation as you always have been?
There will be debt and equity, but not grants, and there is a limitation on the amount of it.
True. On page 6, mm-hmm. line 19, it allows you to make grants with no percentage limitation.
Well, and what? Loans?
Yes.
What are you reading?
Line 19, page,
line 19, page 6.
With no limitations.
Make grants. Mr. Chairman, that, if I may respond to the Senator's observation, that section 08B5, the B begins, the board may not, and the subsection there modifies
those
that.
Those are the negatives.
Mr. Chairman, and then if you'd look at section 16, basically said the board may not invest in more than 49% of the combined equity and debt of an applicant. It may not own more than 49% of the voting shares and may not finance more than 70% of the cost of the project. Mr. Chairman, there's two things I'd like you to look at. One in response to Senator Sackett. On section 2 and the purposes, and one of the things we've tried to tighten up on this bill is to say what it could do and then to write in some measurement standards. And I think that's been a problem on a lot of our loan funds is perhaps the direction not clear enough, and then the ability to monitor that. In section 2, we set forth the purposes, such as the development capital for establishment and expansion of small enterprises. Then in section 21, we require reports, financial statements, investment appraisal, performance report, overall financial plan. We've gone into some detail to say that they have to tell us how they're meeting the goals of the organization, and I think that's something that's been lacking perhaps before.
Senator Lyons,
we back to section 27 as it relates to expanding the program. You mentioned that, of course, most is adequately covered by other loan programs. That's not going to be a consideration in this particular bill. Unless I'm mistaken, tourism is also covered under other loan programs. The mining is covered under other loan programs. Agriculture is covered under other loan programs. So what I can understand is that if we're going to increase our ability to get into other areas and they're only going to have $3 million to play with, it seems to me that we're not doing a great deal except what Senator Dankwer says, sort of restructure to try to get it back on some type of a basis where maybe we can look at it again next year. But it doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense to expand a program into other areas where there are already loan programs available with only this short funding.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lyson, one of the things that this bill does is to allow flexibility it does get into the area of development finance. It is not the same as the other bills that are, say, at a fixed rate, in many cases, a subsidized interest rate. This allows some flexibility in how the package is put together to assist, small businesses getting into areas. And so it has flexibility that the other programs do not have built into it. And I can't tell you what the long-term demand would be for the program, how much demand there would be for future dollars.
But in effect, what you're saying, that the other programs are subsidized one manner or another through interest rates. Mm-hmm. I know that the mining is, and tourism, I suspect, and agriculture. So
there wouldn't be that much of a demand on this particular program if the interest rate's going to be at the market.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if you could respond as to your view, perhaps, Mr. Littleton or Mr. Olson, as to what kind of a demand you might get in the future for a program like this. I would think for a small business coming off, this might be an extremely useful program.
Mr. Chairman, these are different kinds of funds, and as you pointed out, in that they are equity monies or can be a combination of debt and equity. And that has always been ARC's novel characteristic or feature. And a new business, for new businesses, that is very, very often the kind of capital that it most lacks. And so rather than a broad brush, what I think is important to recognize that this entity, this new ARC, is not competitive, not displacing or replacing other programs, but is making available to a broader arena of markets that kind of special capital that is required by startup and new enterprises.
Aren't we saying, maybe I'm not saying it correctly, but when you say we're making equity money available, can't you conversely say we're making interest-free money available?
I don't regard it that way at all.
But isn't it actually? What return does the state get? I don't see a lot of money coming into the general fund from any of these sources.
Well, Mr. Chairman, perhaps one of the reasons is it's a very new program, and investments into equity very often require a gestation period before the buyout occurs, and it is not until the buyback of that equity shares, that interest that is acquired by the investor early on, the buyback by the investee, that one sees the return, it becomes a material return. That could be 7 to 8, 9 years after the initial investment.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest you might want to take a look at section 11 of the bill. And of course, I suppose one of the things, you have to have performance to find out if things carry out. But what it calls for is investing in projects that are economically viable. And it goes on to say investments may not be made at below market rates. So, you know, the intent is there, that's in the bill, and obviously then you have to hold an agency accountable. Hey, have you done what you said you would do, and actually at this point of time produce that market rate of return? And that's one of the things I say we've beefed up on that reporting part, but that becomes then the success, I suppose, of the agency over a period of time.
Senator, do you perceive that this section 11 as managed as prudently as Mr. Rasmussen has with our permanent fund?
It's a different kind of a vehicle, obviously, than a permanent fund. Quite a different vehicle.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator?
The problem that always bothered me with ARC was this getting into equity positions and stuff, and I suppose it's concerned you guys as operated too, because there's a question as to how much government should get involved as part of the finances. It still remains in here, but given that, and some have just about persuaded me that it isn't all that bad if it's controlled, and it is a way of getting involved, but is there anything in here, and you may answer this too, honest, that would, I always said that if we get in and we help Mr. Snobble out, or we help Mr. So-and-so out, or we get into a business in an equity position, as long as I can see you getting out. But I didn't want the state to someday end up owning 40% of Western Airlines, a half of Captain Cook, and a few other things, and we never get out. Because the thing's not making any money, it was a bad investment. Is there anything in here that would say that that we cannot hold, we must disperse of our equity position in the business within 10 years, or at least part of the financial plan of the loan would include an earmarked time, at which time this contract with this outfit requires that we liquidate our assets out of that.
Mr. Chairman,
would have been 10 years.
I'm sure there'll be a response there, but Senator, if you would turn to to section 14 on page 5.
All right.
Requires that the corporation makes an equity investment agrees to start investing itself the shares held within 10 years or before the end of the term of loan, whichever occurs first.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that's there. But
possibly there's some response.
Well, we might not want to make it 10 years, but that at least sees your way out. I could see times when maybe 20 years would make sense, but I don't know the circumstance. Whether 10 years at this time is too bad would make sense. But as long as I can see a contract that says the state will help you, but as a part of this financing plan, you can plan on the state of Alaska getting out on a certain date, and if, you know, that's when we're liquidating, we were required to get out. That satisfies me, though.
The question that kind of leaves me a little bit hanging out here, maybe Senator Sertuski, you've looked into it. It says they agree to start divesting. That could be a 50-year plan.
Would you, Mr. Chairman? The difficulty in putting a, sir, in putting an end time to it is that it presents a an unfair almost opportunity to the investee. If Company X were, shares of Company X were owned by this new company, the new ARC, and it knew that the buyout provision required that the shares be reacquired by that company by the end of, say, 15 years, provides a tremendous awkwardness to the negotiation of that buyout and those values by that time, at the end of that period. So we felt that it most prudent in our recommendations to the Senator's staff that there be clear language requiring the beginning of the buyout, but that it not be regarded as prudent to have an end to it. But the intent is certainly, and has been, and is certainly here again underscored as being to ensure that this is a temporary phenomenon and that the company ultimately buys out the interest that has been acquired.
Isn't it, just in summing this up and not belittling this one particularly, but doesn't this in fact, and people have obviously legal training, doesn't this in fact mean that you don't have to get out within a particular time frame?
Senator? If a company into which the company, this new ARC were to invest takes off as is planned and hoped for with good earnings, the net worth builds strongly in the early years, the intention would be and should be that the shares be reacquired and that the ARC be taken out. The tough part is, sir, that in some cases the earnings don't accumulate quite as rapidly as everyone planned in the early years, and so the company becomes, or the risk is, that a company will become something called a walking wounded in the trade, that neither earns great, its net worth neither accumulates rapidly, nor does it go bankrupt or become difficult for it. But it doesn't have the capital to reacquire the shares. There is always that risk that a company won't perform well enough to buy back the shares without decapitalizing itself. There is always that risk.
I take it that your answer is that this, in fact, means that you really don't have to get out within any time frame.
Could be there for some time, sir. Depends upon the performance of the company, principally.
Senator Stimson, did you hear?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I happen to be one that has not been nearly as critical of ARC as some of my colleagues. I think one of the mistakes we've made as legislature is the mistake somebody would make when they were planted a tree and they pull it out by the roots to see how it's doing. And I guess I think because of the problems that, or at least the perception of problems that have evolved in the last year or so, that this approach is good in the sense that, in my opinion, it's important that the resource corporation be allowed to continue on. I'm a little concerned with dropping of the word renewable I understand some of the background behind that, but I think the role that you play in terms of providing venture capital for renewable industries is absolutely critical in the development of the state. And I guess my specific question to you would be, obviously you're supportive of the legislation. Does it allow you, in your opinion, to still move toward what the original intended purpose of the creation of the Alaska Renewable Resources Corporation was, or are we making a major shift in your direction?
Mr. Chairman, this is a major shift. This new corporation will be more conservative than the older ARC was, because it must live within a certain constrained down. It must live within its budget, its own budget described by its earnings. It would make investments over a broader arena, hence there would be fewer. The proportion of the portfolio would be fewer, relatively less in renewables over time. It'd be natural. There would be a tendency as well, in addition to conservativeness in investment philosophy and policy, there would be a tendency as well to gravitate toward the higher yield opportunities, and that may or may not be in renewables, probably would not be in renewables. So there is a significant policy shift that you're reviewing here.
You may have already answered this question, but something that came to mind while you were talking that I read in the newspaper the other day that you've already answered it, I'd like to have the answer. Why did you hold the ARC board meeting in Seattle? I saw you advertise that you were holding your board meeting in the state of Washington.
Well, they have investments outside the state.
And I want to know why the board was held out in the meeting.
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, that was the first time we held a board meeting outside of the state. It seemed a reasonable thing to do. A couple of the companies, larger investments that we have their offices in the Seattle area, and this provided us an opportunity to spend a full day with the principals in those companies.
It had kind of a bad feeling for those that read it up in Alaska. They wondered, well, here's our renewable resource board holding their hearings in Seattle, which, of course, none of us could afford, and the average citizen couldn't afford to fly down in a tent. I guess you guys took that into consideration. We fly down there for the convenience of a couple of investors in the state of Washington where you invested. It looks like to me they could have come to our meetings, but I would hope that these Alaska corporations wouldn't do that anymore. I'd like to see them hold their hearings in Alaska. I won't pass judgment on you. I guess you guys know what you're doing in that regard, but it didn't look good.
Senator Sagan?
I'm not at the report that Senator Sturgeon-Lewski passed out. Of the investments we have, correct me if I'm wrong, and see if this has changed. The delinquent loans, as of September 30th, the principal, they were on loans totaling $7,000,084. Past due on those specific loans was $1,000,007. Has that changed at all?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like Mr. Littleton to respond to that.
Mr. Chairman, the list that you're looking at, could you give me those figures again, Senator?
Okay. Of your total investment of $39 or $47 million, the principal balance of $7 million is delinquent, according to the accountant. The outstanding loans of those of that $7 million, $1,000,007 is past due.
The delinquent loan totals there include two major investments. One is Alaska Food Company, I believe.
Yeah.
And the other one is Solitoff Seafoods, both of which are in Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Oh.
By being in bankruptcy, they can't make payments. Technically, they're delinquent. That's why we're considering them such. They're in the process of reorganization now. Looks bright for both of them.
Senator Decker.
Well, is there any other question? If there's not, I haven't had a chance to do some work. If it's all right with you, could we hold this till tomorrow morning?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's fine. This is it's obviously a new direction. There's been a lot of legislative interest. We've tried to, touch bases with people, and I certainly think that's excellent. If there are other questions while these gentlemen are here or other issues, well, I appreciate having those.
I'm not suggesting tabling on that. I just want to.
Sure,
Mr. Spear, are you wanting to say something before we adjourn?
Well, and yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in response to Senator Stimson's question, I haven't really had a chance to analyze it because I saw it for the first time this morning, but I think the most dramatic change is in Section 16. And I think, in considering the bill, although the limitation as far as the $500,000 is basically a small business approach, and one which I think is an area that needs to be addressed, I think you have to look at what type of so-called deal flow that those kind of limitations bring you. That is, I don't really understand the 70% and 49% section there, but it seems to me to say that you have to, an applicant has to come to the corporation with $520,000 in either debt or equity in order to get $500,000 out of the company. And that describes to me either a company that has a great deal of equity already built up and could probably find debt financing somewhere else, or someone who already has a lot of debt build up, or at least a commitment for debt. And I don't know how many, it would just be speculation on all of our parts, I suppose, to see how many companies would do that. I haven't seen that many applicants come into our doors, although ours, our limitations have been more open. I don't foresee many rural projects, for instance, or any research and development type of deals that would be able to come in with that kind of financing. But it's, I think it's the most dramatic change to the legislation, and one that really is the type of organization we have is going to be described by the type of applicants and investments that come up, and that's the section that does it.
Mr. Chairman, in other words, it is, as has been pointed out, it's a more conservative approach.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, just a final comment, if I may. I certainly appreciate, we certainly appreciate your attention to the company and its history and the need for legislative, new legislative agendas. And by and large, I regard this piece of legislation as a reasonable new beginning. Certainly appreciate your efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Committee members, tomorrow morning's meeting will be at 8 o'clock. There's about six different bills scheduled, so sooner we get started. First item on the calendar this morning will be Senate Bill 875, Transfer of Ownership and Management of University of Alaska Trust Lands. And I should point out at the time that Senate Bill 876 is a companion bill. Commissioner Katz, would you like to come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll make my remarks brief this morning, and there's also a representative of the university here should you have additional questions. We are very strongly supportive of the University Lands Agreement, which was negotiated by the Department of Natural Resources on behalf of the administration and does impact other state agencies. We believe that this agreement is a fair and just settlement of pending litigation. In our judgment, it should not be construed as a land trade or some sort of a voluntary agreement. In the absence of this kind of agreement, the litigation would continue, and the concomitant uncertainty that would be created, I think, would inure to everybody's detriment. To my knowledge, there is no outstanding opposition to the agreement within the four corners of that agreement. The municipality of Anchorage also has litigation pending with the university and would like very much to settle their litigation within the context of this agreement, and I'll address myself to that in a couple of minutes, but so far as I know, they do not object to the substance of the agreement. Similarly, there are some people in the legislature and outside who have concerns that are more generally related to the university and the budget process. Those are beyond my purview to address and beyond the purview of the agreement. The agreement consists of three principal parts. The first is a conveyance of all right, title, and interest and the management of university grant lands. And that's a little bit in excess of 100,000 acres. In arriving at that solution, we looked at every other feasible alternative and concluded that there really was none. Must admit that I personally came 180 degrees to reach that conclusion. I looked at such alternatives as the creation of a division of trust lands in the Department of Natural Resources and other approaches. But the problem is that so long as those lands are part of the state public domain, they tend to be treated by both the legislature and the administration as just a part of the public domain. The judge pointed out that that approach is an error, that in fact the state of Alaska has a trust responsibility to the university, and that the rules and regulations that we apply generally to the state public domain may not necessarily comply with the trust requirements that pertain to university land. And I think really the only way to assure all of ourselves that the trust obligations will be met in the future is to segregate those lands and put them under the management of the regions. In that regard, it is my understanding that questions have arisen about what plan the regents might utilize in the development of their lands and how they might dispose of the proceeds from that development. And the university officials who are here can speak to that better than I, but it is my understanding that, in fact, they do intend to respond to requests, that they produce a plan and indicate how the income would be utilized. The second part of the agreement involves an appropriation of $500,000 to the Department of Law and then subsequently to the university and to the Department of Natural Resources. That money is for two principal purposes. The first and most important is the appraisal of a number of interests in land that have been created over the years and do detract from the value of land that the university would otherwise have. So in our judgment, it was necessary to determine what that valuation was in order that just compensation can be provided. The second component of the financing would consist of two additional positions at DNR for a reasonably short period of time in order to administer the agreement. And while it's my understanding that no request for a fiscal note or backup financial information has been made, we do have some if the committee is interested. The third component relates to the future. Under that approach, the parties have agreed on a methodology for evaluating the encumbrances and other occurrences which have led to a reduction in the value of certain university lands. Prior to the next legislative session, those encumbrances would be evaluated by appraisers and an amount of money or other consideration would be determined. The administration was not willing to sign off, and the future legislature could not be bound by the results of that process. So what we propose is that the valuation which results from the process be presented to the next governor and to the next legislature, and they, in their discretion, will have to determine how to deal with that. Nobody is bound to that result. It is for that reason that I believe that the concerns of the municipality of Anchorage can be addressed. What we are asking the legislature to do is, in essence, to approve the first two parts of the agreement, but the third part would have to wait until next year. And that third part provides both the substance and the leverage for the municipality of Anchorage to resolve its concerns, hopefully, prior to that time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Strzelewski.
As you know, the Resource Committee did pass a letter of intent dealing, directing really the university and the municipality to negotiate to settle their claims. You have no objection to that going in. I mean, you support that approach.
Yes, we do, and we've offered for whatever it's worth any of our good offices to try and bring the parties together and assist in that regard.
Fine, thank you.
Any other questions, the Commissioner? Commissioner, let me ask you, how many acres approximately or how many sites have potentially been identified as those which were the decisions going to have to be made about?
I couldn't hear the last phrase. Identified.
How many acres or how many sites, different sites, are going to have to be decided as to?
The university grant land total is just a little in excess of 100,000 acres, and that's discernible now and would be conveyed. I'm not sure exactly how many interests of different kinds will have to be evaluated. There are, and Mary Tutton, who's here, may have a ready answer for that. There are several appendices to the agreement, and each of them deals with different kinds of interests that have been created and must be evaluated through the appraisal process.
Are there any other questions? No. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who cares to testify on this bill? Senator Sackett?
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that we have put out sample 875, committee substitute, and a letter of intent with individual recommendations.
All in favor of the motion, signify by raising your hand. Bill passed out individual recommendation along with the letter of intent. I think we also need a motion, if we will, on the companion bill.
Mr. Chairman, move that the House consent to send out Senate Bill 876 with individual recommendations.
All in favor of the motion, signify by raising your hand. Motion carries, individual recommendation. Both bills are moved out of committee. The next item that we'll take up is Senate Bill 880, an act relating to the sale of royalty oil by the state of Alaska to Doyon Limited.
Chairman, noticing that some members of the committee have been present at prior presentations of these contracts, I'd like to offer you three options and have the committee decide how you would like to proceed. I'm prepared to give you a full-blown version of the process, the policies, and the contracts, or in the alternative, to give you the Reader's Digest version of those items, or in the alternative, simply to respond to questions that the committee members might have.
Senator, second.
Attorney Tarry, the Reader's Digest.
Okay. I'll do it as quickly as I can. These contracts are presented to you through as a result of a very arduous process that began back in last July. Rather than belabor each component of that process, let me just indicate that we started with 29 proponents at the beginning, winnowed down through those to the two contracts that we're presenting to you today. That process is documented in great detail in a commissioner's finding document, which is in excess of some 200 pages and has been made available to the committee, as I understand it. Also, we have summarized that document in a document that's about 14 pages long, and is also available to the committee. At this point in time, we have two contracts to present, the Tesoro contract and the so-called Doyon 1 contract. In addition, we are continuing negotiations with three parties. The Provident Oil Company of Arizona, which has offered a very high premium on state royalty oil, and has shown us some other elements that made us feel that we could not reject that contract at this time. Secondly is the Sunil Trading Company, which has proposed the idea of using Petrocoke as a blend with royalty oil. And because I very much support the development of coal, that's an interesting concept that ought not to be rejected out of hand either. However, there are three really fundamental issues that have to be addressed. One is the technological issue. Secondly is the issue of why Petrocoke is why royalty oil is necessary as leverage for Petrocoke. And the third is the imminence or lack of imminence of the project. The third ongoing set of negotiations involves Chevron USA. Made a firm offer of 18,000 barrels a day to supply the Nikiski refinery. There are 20,000 additional barrels at issue now, and they would be exported to California for refining there and the return of products to the state. Our statutes require, in that kind of circumstance, a, quote, special supply or price benefit. We did not feel that such a benefit was forthcoming yet. However, the negotiations have been productive, and we want to continue them. These contracts were negotiated in accordance with several major principles that I will briefly indicate, and I think because they are involved in each and every contract, will give you an understanding of the contracts as well. The first such policy was a clear preference for in-state processing and refining. That preference is provided in existing law. It's not an absolute preference, but basically speaking, everything else being equal, Alaska industry should be favored over export. Secondly, we were very concerned about impacts of our negotiations and contracts on the marketplace. And so we developed a policy of governmental neutrality, of non-intervention to the maximum extent that we possibly could. We are aware that all of the existing refineries in one way or another compete with each other, and the advent of a Doyon refinery would add to that competition, and therefore we were very conscious of our need not to inadvertently advantage or disadvantage one company in relationship to the others. The next policy related to the price term. The current Exhibit B price term, I think by most accounts, has not worked all that well. It's now the subject of litigation in Amerada Hess versus the state. It also tends to disadvantage in-state taking and processing because in-state takers really don't have any firm knowledge of the actual price of a transaction which they're involved in until about 60 days after that transaction occurs. We looked at every price term that anybody has ever seen in a royalty oil contract, not only governmental contracts, but contracts among private companies. That included market crudes, evergreen arrangements, and other sorts of things. On the basis of that approach, we concluded that the most equitable methodology was to adopt the weighted average field price of the producers on the North Slope. I think that formulation speaks for itself. The weighted average field price would be adjusted, however, by whatever happens in Amerada Hess. And if the state is successful in that litigation, not only would we receive the base price which is owing us, but an amount of interest that would be 3% above the prime rate or the treasury rate, whichever is higher. So we feel that in that regard, we've taken cognizance of whatever may occur in this uncertain litigation. The next major principle relates to the term of the contracts. Each of these contracts is for 12 years. That is a very lengthy term in royalty oil in oil transactions, as a matter of fact, and is of value to the two companies involved. Prudhoe Bay production begins to decline 8 years from now. We picked the 12-year term for two reasons. One is we wanted to provide equity among all the folks that were participating, that were competing for royalty oil. And Doyon did need a longer term than the others because it is a new entrant and needed the financing related to new entry. Secondly, after the 12-year period, Prudhoe Bay production declines really precipitously. And we wanted to maximize the options of the governor and the legislature at that time, in essence, to write on a blank slate as much as possible and to determine what state royalty oil policy should be in the years of decline if we do not make new discoveries. The next policy that we adopted related to volume. We wanted to retain a substantial amount of uncommitted volume for a couple of reasons. First, this is not a good time to be negotiating royalty oil contracts. There is, as all of you know, a glut on the world market. The state doesn't have at this point in time nearly the negotiating leverage that it might have in a shortage situation. So we wanted to permit the next governor and legislature to have that flexibility should the circumstances change. Secondly, there are a number of very interesting proposals for the use of state royalty oil, which have really not yet come to fruition. The financing isn't there, but the concept is worth looking at. And on that basis, we did not want to preclude their access to royalty oil in the future by disposing of all the volume that we have. So the volumes involved here are 46,000 for Tesoro, minus the Cook Inlet production that they now receive, and 50,000 for Doyon. Hopefully a return oil arrangement can be worked out that would reduce that gross refinery charge. That means that we will have a minimum of 60,000 barrels a day, counting Prudhoe and Taparik, and we may have more than that. The next concept that was included in our negotiations was a reservation fee or an option fee, because it was our judgment that once the state has made a commitment of royalty oil to a proponent, that the loss of the flexibility to use that royalty oil in other situations is a detriment to the state, which is quantifiable in some term. This is a new policy that was not embodied in our prior royalty oil contracts, but we felt very strongly about it, having talked to royalty oil traders all over the country. We did make one concession on the reservation fee in the instance of Doyon. The Doyon contract, in our view, involved the competition between two very important but competing policies. One was new entry, and we felt that new entry was very important initially to the interior Alaska situation, and subsequently could be very important to to price competition in the whole rail belt area and perhaps even beyond that. The second policy was the reservation fee, which we felt strongly about for the reasons I indicated. However, in the clash between those two competing policies in this instance, we chose the former, and therefore suspended the moratorium or suspended the reservation fee for 4 years. That's the amount of time that MAPCO, the existing North Pole refinery, has had an opportunity to penetrate the market. The amount of money involved isn't all that great. The principle was important to us, but we think in terms of the state's best interest that promoting new competition should prevail. I do feel compelled to mention, Don Mould is here and may be testifying this morning, that on this point the Royalty Oil and Gas Board disagreed with us and felt that the reservation fee should become operative from the very beginning of the contract. The next policy relates to interim taking. We observed what happened in the Alpetco situation and developed a policy in adamant opposition to interim taking. All of our current negotiations involve, in essence, turnkey operations. No state royalty oil would be provided on an interim basis to anybody, particularly if that kind of interim taking were necessary to finance a project which otherwise did not have financing. The next policy was our willingness to provide 100% of royalty oil to in-state refinery or processing operations. We considered a lesser amount, some arbitrary amount like not being willing to provide more than 50 or 60% of the total volume. But we concluded that the benefit to the state was not all that great of having those additional volumes. The volumes weren't all that great. And the detriment to the companies involved could be very great. Tesoro for years has been on the world market looking for oil, has not had the security of a royalty oil contract, and I think without question that that's had to dampen at least a little bit some of the things they might otherwise have done. Similarly, the Doyon operation is very much dependent on crude oil flowing through the TAPS pipeline, and again, we felt that a decision of a smaller percentage was arbitrary and would have a significant disadvantage. Another policy that we have worked through is the return oil problem. That involves pipeline refineries like MAPCO and hopefully the Doyon operation. They accept a gross refinery charge, but then return a significant amount of oil to the pipeline for possible downstream use. We saw the opportunity for the state to maximize the volume it was dealing with by, in essence, using the same oil twice, because MAPCO or Doyon would be required to pay a quality penalty. And then if the state chose, it could reassert jurisdiction or enter into some series of exchanges of oil that might mean that some other downstream purchaser of the state could use that oil. Unfortunately, that policy has not yet come to fruition because we've not yet entered into a contract with a downstream purchaser. The next policy involved rural Alaska. At this point in time, it is probably not reasonable to expect that anybody will be willing to build a new refinery in rural Alaska because the refinery margins these days are so slim. However, in every set of negotiations we asked a basic question, which is what are you willing to do for rural Alaska in the way of distribution or price or something else that would be helpful? Unfortunately, the company most capable of doing that because of its distribution network is Chevron, and we don't yet have a contract with them, but that is certainly a concept that we are pursuing. The next issue concerns Petrocoke that I referred to briefly before. Unfortunately, for some reason or another, that issue has tended to dominate some of the royalty oil discussions. We do see the possibility of using royalty oil to complement development of state coal resources. And for that reason, we have examined and are continuing to examine the possibility of using royalty oil to obtain the purchase of Petrocoke that would then be blended with Alaska coal, probably somewhere on the Pacific Rim. We first pursued the possibility of a generalized option which the state would exercise on behalf of some company or companies, and we felt that that was advantageous because it would assure equity among all possible developers of Alaska coal. Right now, those negotiations have not yielded positive results, and as I indicated before, we're continuing to discuss with Suneel the possibility of a specific contract relating to their concerns. The next item I want to bring to the attention of the committee, and it's particularly appropriate for the Finance Committee, is the possible impact of in-state taking on the in-value price which the state receives. Without going into a lot of detail, in-state taking does impact the in-value price because it results in a displacement of royalty crude on the West Coast. There is a two-tier type price system right now involving the West Coast and the Gulf Coast. And the West Coast price is higher and is reflected back in Alaska's revenues and severance taxes. Therefore, displacement on the West Coast does have a negative impact. However, the scenarios could change. In some situations, the Gulf Coast price could be higher. In that kind of situation, the state would actually benefit from in-kind taking and displacement on the West Coast. So we have identified a total possible negative impact associated with each contract of $4 million for each. But that impact could be less or negligible or actually positive for the state, depending on a number of speculative scenarios relating to the future that none of us could predict. In the case of the Tesoro contract, Tesoro has provided us, and I guess this morning will provide you, with documentable evidence of its positive secondary and tertiary economic benefit for the state of Alaska. And we felt that possibility of a negative impact was more than made up for by the very real probability of positive impacts. We feel the same way about the Doyon contract, although there we've not yet been able to obtain information as readily quantifiable as we have for Tesoro. But there is no question that there would be much accelerated price competition, first in interior Alaska and later elsewhere, and that would inure to the citizens of Alaska. In addition, there would be increased employment and supplier contracts and other things, which, though we don't have a firm handle on, would clearly be a benefit. The last couple of policies I'll discuss very briefly. We received more than a couple of proposals that sought to use state royalty oil as leverage for something that was really unrelated to hydrocarbons or oil disposition. We chose not to provide royalty oil in those situations. The relationships were too attenuated. There's no question that royalty oil could be good leverage for opening a widget factory in Alaska. But query whether that's a proper use of state royalty oil and how we would distinguish between one company and another on that basis. Another thing that we felt very strongly about was adequate security for our contracts in view of what's happened with Alpetco. We do have very firm security in our contracts. Among other things, they consist of a letter of credit amounting to the value of 2 months of the royalty oil, very tough contract provisions, and provisions that in essence defer to the commissioner's interpretation of the contract in many instances. I was frankly pleased by one proponent's half-joking comment that this was the toughest contract that he had actually been willing to sign, because it showed, at least to me, that we had towed the line between not being too unreasonable and yet trying to develop fairly tough contracts for a very important state commodity. I should also indicate that these contracts reflect not only the best advice and work of the Attorney General's office, but when we had completed that process, we exposed them to one of the best commercial law firms in the United States that provided additional comment. And I feel very comfortable on that, on the basis of that review, that we've rectified some of the problems that have materialized in the past. The net result of all that I've just said, Mr. Chairman, is that we are presenting to you two contracts. The Tesoro contract we present without reservation. We believe it is clearly in the state's interests. The Doyon contract we present to you with only one reservation. It's an important one, but we believe that there is a solution for that reservation. When we negotiated our contract with Doyon, all the elements of a successful refinery operation were in place, including financing. Unfortunately, for certain reasons, that financing has now slipped. Doyon is very actively engaged now in the process of trying to find other financing. That involves two steps. The first is what to do with their royalty oil. The second is to return to the banks and deal with them on the basis of what they've been able to accomplish. Initially, I thought that if they were not successful in that endeavor by the time that the legislature adjourned, that the contract then should be disapproved. But the day that the legislature adjourns is at best arbitrary and has no relationship to royalty oil. Also, Doyon is really trying hard to obtain financing. And therefore, we felt comfortable with the approach that is embodied in the bill that you have received from the Senate Resources Committee. We do have a very firm policy of providing royalty oil to projects which are imminent and viable. And I think that that's premised on a number of very good reasons. Briefly, that was the distinguishing feature of our current negotiations, and I think it would be unfair to people who we rejected because their proposals were not imminent for us to adopt a different policy now. In particular, that could disadvantage Tesoro. It's not a determinative disadvantage, but they have some very important decisions to make in the next year or so relating to possible expansion, and the uncertainty of what might happen with respect to a competitor, I think, would clearly contribute to that. Perhaps the most important reason for our concern is that I think in the future, the governor and the legislature will be called upon to consider other proposals. And if we provide royalty oil to a proponent whose project is not reasonably imminent and viable, what do we do the next time and the next time similar proposals are made? However, on the basis of all that I've said, we believe that it is reasonable and not a rationalization for us to say that a go-no-go decision by September 1 does relate to an imminent and viable project, and that because of the policy favoring new entry, we feel comfortable that that's a good date to distinguish what is imminent from what is not. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions from members? Senator Ferguson? Or no. Senator Ankrum?
Okay. My question has to do with the last sentence in there. Don't you have administrative prerogatives under the committee substitute for resources other than the last sentence?
I think we do. I frankly don't know how that got into the bill, Senator, because it was not in the draft that we originally proposed for reasons probably similar to the ones that are generating your question. The House Finance Committee yesterday eliminated that sentence, and we had no problem with that elimination.
Pursue that. Alice, do you know why that was put in resource? Was that put in resource?
Mr. Chairman, I don't. Right,
can I see you? There must be some
rationale. Well, here's the rationale, Senator, but I believe it's dealt with in the contracts themselves. At the time we were negotiating initially with Doyon, they were proceeding on two tracks at the same time, both of which we felt were in the state's best interest. One was the construction of a grassroots refinery. The second was the purchase of a controlling interest in the MAPCO refinery. We were willing to negotiate with Doyon two contracts on that basis, but felt that they should be mutually exclusive. And the current contracts already provide for a deadline determination of May 1.
Yeah.
So this language is really a surplus to what the contracts already require.
Are there any other questions? Senator Dinkins?
Well, of course, one of the things, it's not so much a question, and you and I have discussed this before, but y'all made a policy that taking all royalty all in advance of whatever you say you're going to do. I really have a question sometimes. I know you have a bad experience, so you never do something again because of something you've just done before. But I don't think that, it seems to me that when somebody comes, Doyon, somebody, whoever it is, comes to us with a proposal, it's an entire package. And the package could include benchmarks that we can take the in-kind oil, or we can take the oil in advance, provided that we reach this benchmark or that. But sometimes that's the ingredient that puts the package together. Just as if, on the other end, you come and say, okay, once we get to the refinery, if we have someone who will take the return oil, that helps put the package together, if you have the sale of that. So it seems like to me that at least some consideration should be given to an entire financing package rather than by policy eliminate certain things and say, well, because we once had an experience and the person didn't meet that benchmark. I think it would have been in the best interest of the state to look at the financing package as a whole, and if it makes sense as a whole, then maybe there would be those times when you could take the oil in advance. But I know you've got a pretty good argument to that, but
I don't necessarily sooner disagree with what you've said in every instance. So the proposals that we had this time around, I think, were fairly easy on the interim taking issue. There's not one that I can recall right offhand where all the elements were in place or close to being in place except the need for interim taking. Our experience in the past has shown that the benchmark of issue can create real problems because it is so subject to interpretation. For that reason, in these contracts, we only have one definitive benchmark, and that is relating to the Doyon contract when the refinery should be up and operating. But I agree with you, I think. If a proposal came along and the package in totality was there, and the one element that might be missing was that, I wouldn't want to have a hard and fast rule for all time on that.
I think that's probably, that satisfies me, at least if I'm reading it right, that's not such a hard and fast rule, that if the proposal made sense, it was in the best interest of the state, you're still flexible enough to look at that.
Yeah, it was easy, as I say, with these, and frankly, I think it would have been fairly easy for us in the Alpetco situation, although hindsight is always 20/20, because some of the other elements weren't there either. But these sorts of projects, as you know, consist of several elements, and if there's some assurance about market penetration or some of the others, then the interim taking thing isn't so troublesome.
Well, we'll take, Mr. Chairman, that satisfies me. And I don't think my question on that doesn't, like I said, apply to the things that are before us today. I don't know that was part of that package at all anyway. But we had discussed that policy and the concern. What's the difference if you in each one of these contracts, you say it's about $4 million less in state revenue for in-state taking. And what would be the difference? Or would there be a difference we'll say on the 50,000 barrels of Doyon oil and they return back in 18,000 to 22,000, say they took 40,000 and they returned 22,000 barrels back into the line, and that 22,000 was picked up by one of the majors. Now what would that, and it goes to the West Coast, would that change that $4 million figure?
No, Senator, two quick responses. The $4 million figure, just to put it in context, is our judgment about the most reasonable pessimistic projection, and It is very likely that it could be less than that, and as I indicated, under some scenarios, it could even be positive. But we wanted to use that figure so that you could see the full implications of your action. It is my understanding, in response to your question, that once oil has been removed from the process at pump station 1, we cannot then return it later downstream and ameliorate the impacts in terms of the two-tier price structure. So once the decision is made, for better or worse, it's irrevocable.
Right. Well, just in closing, I'm glad that you did do that on the Doyle line. I don't know how that'll get you in the future and other people who might bid and want an extension on that date. But I, you know, for my own personal belief, I've gone out and I'm trying personally to help Doyon put some financing together. I think it's just so important that Alaskans start getting involved in this royalty oil business. I'd like to see any firm, anybody get involved. We don't have enough of it. And I'm glad that you're giving them that time to put that financing together. Whether it be a conflict of interest or not, I don't know, but I certainly am going to help them do that if I can. I hope they're pretty good.
Any questions for any member of the committee? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else present who wishes to testify on the Doyon contract?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier on, I passed out a copy of testimony that I had given earlier last week. And so rather than go through that again, I'll just answer any questions if anybody has any.
For the benefit of the members, Tim Wallace is the president of Doyon Limited and is available for any questions that any of you may have. Any questions for members of the committee?
What's his name?
Sandra Lyson.
Tim, how did that particular sentence get into the resources bill? Do you recall? Is that put into your request?
I have no idea how that sentence got in there.
It was there. It was not questioned. I think that's about the only answer we could give. We won't give you credit.
Senator Ferguson?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we delete the last sentence in there, starting with the on the 18th line, ending with 1982 on the 21st line.
We have a motion before the committee to delete that sentence. All in favor? Deleted. Any further questions of Mr. Wallace? Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Anyone further to testify on this particular bill? Senator Sackett?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferguson?
I have one more amendment, and that would be on line 15. Change September 1, 1982 date to October 1, 1982. This will give one more month for them to put their packs together. And I believe it's important that they do this because this is the last in company. Just to give them enough time to negotiate.
Motion before the committee is on line 15, change September 1 to October 1. All in favor? Motion carries. Any further motions? Senator Sackett.
Mr. President, I move that the absent carry put this bill out with individual recommendations, and maybe we should have somebody else make the motion because I've got to move to request not to vote on this issue.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I would move the SB or the resources. SB 880 as amended in the Finance Committee. Unanimous consent.
All in favor? Carried.
Chairman?
Yes.
May substitute for SB 881 resources dealing with the Tesoro contract with individual recommendation.
Could you withdraw this motion?
I've got to move,
for the record, I have to move and ask unanimous consent that I be allowed not to vote on the Doyon contract.
Object.
I object.
I have no question about your voting will be in the best.